Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fode, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Rick Steves, who reads from his new book, Europe Through the Back Door, 2008, published by Avalon Travel. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Rick Steves grew up in Edmonds, Washington, and studied at the University of Washington, where he received degrees in business administration and European history. But his real education came in Europe. Since 1973, he spent 120 days each year in Europe. Spending a third of his adult life living out of a suitcase, spending a third of his adult life living out of a suitcase in Europe has shaped Rick's thinking. Today, he employs 80 people at his Europe Through the Back Door headquarters in Edmonds, where he produces 30 guidebooks on European travel, the most popular travel series in America on public television, a weekly hour-long national public radio show, and weekly column syndicated by the Chicago Tribune. And as you may have guessed, Rick is in high demand. This is his third event of the day, and he has yet another to go to. So I now will stop talking. Will you please join me in welcoming Rick Steves?
Thank you very much. Yeah, I just was I'm still living in my suitcase because I was in Rome yesterday, and it's great over there. It's my daughter who's a senior in high school's winter break, so, and our son who's third year in college is studying in Rome. So we got to go over there and check it out, and I went to a couple of his classes, and we ate very well every night, and went to a football game, you know, for my first time. That's quite something to go to a football game in Europe. They're very, I mean, it's like the religion. Everybody's out at the stadium on Sunday, you know, and when in high school when a football player was injured, all the kids would get on one knee and kind of pray for them to be okay. In Italy, they chant, "You will die, you will die, you will die." And then if they carry him away on a stretcher, they'll chant, "You'll be back, you'll be back." And then they say, "In Division B." You'll never get it. So they're just, it's really quite energetic. And it's a good example, I think, of trying to do things in Europe that gets you like having an experience instead of just going to the museum. Of course, we want to see the museum, but to have an experience like that is really cool. And to have a friend to take you out there and translate the "you will die" and stuff is also pretty interesting. So it helps you have a clue. I mean, we're out there surrounded by all this Mussolini architecture. I mean, and it just is just a powerful experience with all these fans and so on. So I'm just sort of I'm high on Europe right now. It was a great trip, and I'm also doing a little personal exercise in jet lag, so I'm going to try to be coherent here. And actually, I feel great, and it's wonderful to see you all, and I'm just thrilled to be at the Tattered Cover. This bookstore is one of the great bookstores in the country, and it's just, you guys got a great store here. It's sad. It's sad to see great bookstores, falling down around the country. And a store like this knows they've got to have events like this and remind people that they're here and really be committed to getting the right information. I just feel like it's really, I've got to play. You know, when you're selling books, you can't tell Amazon and Barnes & Noble to go to hell, but because they sell a lot of books. But you also got to remember that it's great in our society, and I think even book lovers that run those big outfits understand how it's really nice to have variety, and it makes the fabric of our reading world and stuff much tougher if we have different people buying books, and it's just really great to be here. So thanks for coming. And what I think I'll do is I'm just going to sort of get you up to date on Europe and talk a little bit about my work and what's happening, and then answer questions, and then be around. So if you want to buy books, I'd be happy to sign them, and so on. And then tonight I'm going to Channel 6. Before I forget, let me just remind you tonight, if you want to tape it or whatever, if you haven't seen these shows, nobody's seen my Burgundy show, which we just shot this year
feature, and we're rushing it out here just for a pledge drive. So it's a brand new debut of a show in Burgundy, which is really a cool show. They're going to run that tonight at the beginning and the end of this little three-hour marathon. We're also going to do a show on how we make our show, which is a fun look at what goes into the making of one of these shows. And then we're going to show you the show we just showed you how we made, which is a logical thing to do. So you'll see the finished version of the Milano show. And then we'll top it off with the Best of Tuscany. So there's going to be a real cool travel festival tonight on Channel 6. I hope you can enjoy that. I think it's from 7 to 10. 7 to 10, yeah. Is it 7 to 11? All right, I'm working longer than I thought. All right. Let me just tell you a little bit about what I do. I never wanted to go to Europe. My mom and dad dragged me there when I was 14 years old. My dad used to import pianos from Germany, and we had to go see the piano factories, and I went to see relatives up in Norway. I remember over there, I remember pretty clearly, I was just like a 14-year-old with a bad attitude, and on day two, it occurred to me, this is not that bad. There was different candy and different pop, and I remember statuesque women with hairy armpits. That was had a major impact on me. I got really exposed to a lot of exciting, different things, and I remember a couple years later over there again with my parents, I was in the Copenhagen train station, and these train stations, to this day, when I'm a tour guide, I take groups, I just have to drop into the train station, even if you got a bus, because there's so much energy coming and go, and I'm always trying to fit it into a TV show and so on. I just love these train stations. And I was in this train station, and I saw kids a couple years older than me with their rucksacks and rail passes and exciting destinations clicking up on those old-fashioned reader boards, you know, Berlin, Amsterdam, Oslo. And then I remember looking over at my mom and dad and looking at these kids, free as the wind, and looking at my mom and dad and thinking, I don't need you guys anymore for this. I can be like them. And I just vowed to go back to Europe every year after that, and I have. At first, I was a piano teacher, and it was clear that the kids would not practice in the summer. So I thought, let's just take a break. I'm not going to, struggle with this one. I'll see you in September. I'm going to Europe. And I was on a very tight budget, and I learned from my tricks. And after three or four trips, it was really clear. I was getting to be a darn good traveler. And what was just as clear is other people were making the same mistakes that I made and learned from the year before. You don't need to be brilliant to learn from your mistakes. Just half awake, you get better at it, you know? And I thought, I'm lucky I get to go back to Europe every year. These people, it's a major thing. It's a retirement trip, or it's a once-in-a-decade experience or whatever. And I just thought, isn't it a shame that somebody can't package the lessons they've learned from these mistakes and put it into a book or a class or something like that? And I thought, I'll do that. And other people can learn from my mistakes rather than their own. And I would have a good excuse to go back to Europe every summer and update my material. So that's what I do since late 70s, I've been spending 4 months a year in Europe, just basically making all the mistakes and taking careful notes. You know, lose my traveler's checks just to see what will happen. Work up a big thirst after a long day of sightseeing in Naples, come back to the hotel, ask for a margarita, and get a pizza. So you learn, you know. Even later, you know, the kids ask for a pepperoni pizza. They don't want peppers. They want they want spicy meatballs or whatever, you know, and they get a pizza covered with green peppers. Well, you learn pepperoni pizza is not what we're looking for. And then you ask, and it's, oh, diabolo or something like that, the devil's meat, very spicy meat. So you learn that in your experience. I just bought some prosciutto. Thank you, prosciutto, at a little Alimentari in Rome a couple days ago, and I said I want 100 grams, and it was 100 grams. I saw it, and he sliced it, and over here, puts it in 100 grams, and then he wraps it up, and he weighs it, and it's all of a sudden 140 grams. Oh, paper. I mean, I said, measure that again, and it was just paper, and I just realized, oh, you pay the price of meat for all the paper, and they wrap it real thick, because it's very profitable to sell. You know, there's just these silly little things. In Rome, the big news from a budget travel and an eating point of view is osteria is old news now, and enoteca is better news. A wine bar that serves good food is a better value. You get great wine by the glass, and you get people that have a small menu, and they serve it with a real interest in quality ingredients that complements the wine. And I was in a couple of great enotecas to work on my new Rome book, and it occurred to me, and I was joking with the waiter about this, you know, everybody's kind of giving little tiny bits of sympathy to Americans with our dollar. Have you heard about our dollar? So I told him, I just want aqua robinetto, tap water. I'm not proud. I want tap water because I want $3 or $4 more to get a nicer glass of wine. you see, and it's a great idea. And I confirmed it with the waiter there. I said, I'll just have tap water so I can have the better wine. And it was a real nice move. You know, we just have to know how to order smarter, and we have to be on the ball, or our trips are going to cost a fortune these days. So that's kind of what I do. I've just doing the same thing I've been doing since I was in the dorm, sharing ideas on traveling, but now I've got 70 or 80 people that work with me, and all sorts of fun technology to amplify what I'm doing. For instance, this last couple of months, we've been really into making iPod tours. And one of the reasons I was in Rome was to try out our new iPod tours. We've got free 1 or 2 hour long guided tours, audio tours of the most important museums in Paris, Venice, Florence, and Rome. And I just downloaded them, like any of our travelers would, and I went to Rome, and I was in the Sistine Chapel instead of reading my book, which I love to do, but it's nice to be able to just look at all the art too, you know, without having to go up and down. So now you've got the tour in your ear, and you can be immersed in the wonder of it all. It's a beautiful thing to be walking around the Pantheon or the Colosseum or the Forum and so on. So they work great, and that's just a fun example of how you can creatively take good information and bring it to travelers en masse in a way that's economic. So we're working very hard to amplify our teaching. For me, the main way we make money is with our tour program. We take 10,000 people to Europe a year on our tours. It's 400 groups a year. I was doing tours before I was doing TV shows or books. Originally, I would give talks like this around Seattle, and I would just, I used to charge for them, and then I realized, well, less people are taking the class. I'll just do it for free, and then I'll, sell a book or take a tour or something like that, and it works out better. And, I would offer these classes, and I always prided myself in having people in the classes that were very honest. I never checked the ID for checks or anything like that. And I had my handbooks for my tours laying around, hoping that people would, during the break, thumb through the handbook and like what they see and take the tour. And time again, people were thumbing through the book, like what they saw, and they took the book. And it occurred to me, these little handbooks for my tours are driving decent people to theft. And you don't need to be a brilliant businessman to know they just should be available for sale. People would love to spend $3.95 for that little book, you know? So I made the Europe in 22 Days book along with my Europe in 22 Days tour, and I reworked it for the next year so that everything I knew about doing the tour was in the book, so people could do the tour without me. And eventually, I had all the tours figured out in these books, and people had the choice to take my little minibus tour or do the tour without me. Back then, I would do these tours, and I would not have an itinerary. I would just sign up 8 people on the minibus. I'd make him sign a little statement that says, if Rick cannot find a hotel, I will sleep on the bus without complaining. And we would go around and we'd come into town at 5 o'clock, and I'd say, okay, everybody scatter for half an hour, look for hotels, we'll meet back here and we'll go to the best place. It was that kind of tour organizing, you know? And every night we would get out the maps and debate where we were going to go the next day. For a first aid kit, I remember all I had was a baggie of Valium, okay? Because I remember once at the circus tent in Munich, waking up at about 3 a.m, and one of my tour members was sitting up, kind of sobbing, saying, Rick, I'm not handling this so very well. And we were surrounded by, you know, it's the circus tent in Munich, so it's like 400 roommates. It's a cross between Woodstock and a slumber party. And you could hear all these Australians kind of rutting in the corner and stuff. And it was just quite stressful for an American who's never been out of our country. And I had this personal crusade to inflict horrible accommodations on soft Americans, just so they would be more thankful when they got home. And I realized early that wasn't no way to build a tour program, so I got over that. But what am I getting at? I guess I'm getting at I experimented with these itineraries for years, and accidentally from that experience I came up with the templates for these books. And these books today are the best-selling books in the country for each of the countries that they cover. And what the nervy thing about these books is, you know, my Italy book was the best. I think this book was the best-selling book to any foreign destination published in the United States last year. Only Disneyland beat it. And and it doesn't even cover Bologna, which is a great city, or, you know, lots of different Torino or whatever. And I just, you know, decided after a lot of experimenting, I've learned how to cut through the superlatives. It's so important for a guidebook writer to be able to say, well, to have an alternative to you can spend a lifetime in Florence. You know, people love to say you can spend a lifetime in Florence. Well, I know you can spend a lifetime in Florence, but I got 1.5 days. Now, how am I going to use them? You see, now you're talking. We Americans have the shortest vacation in the rich world, and we got to cut through the superlatives. It's really refreshing, for somebody to say, if you got less than a month in England, do not do Oxford and Cambridge. do Oxford or Cambridge and save up time for something entirely different. Because variety is good for your itinerary. And Cambridge is better than Oxford. See, now that's real information, I think, from a travel writing point of view. Now, you may say Oxford's better than Cambridge, and I'll just say you're wrong, okay? It's and a guidebook should have opinions, I think. So that's what I try to do, is have these opinions. I just confirmed when I was in Rome that Nero's house, which is pretty important archaeologically speaking, is really a disappointing site. You know, it's the house just behind the Colosseum, and it's a very important place, but from a tourism point of view, it's just really boring, and it's not bad in itself, but if you go there, you're not going to the Baths of Diocletian, which are much nicer and much more interesting. So that's what I'm really aware of, because I've had the reality of trying to put a tour together for people that want to see it all, but I've got to sort through it and give them the best itinerary, and also an ability to realize that Americans do not have an ability to continually enjoy Madonnas and children. I mean, you're good for five or six. And I want you to see the good ones. So I'm not going to waste your attention on mediocre ones if I know the Raphaels are coming up. The same thing with hill towns. I go to a bunch of hill towns, then I get to my favorite hill towns, and half the bus just stays on the bus because they've seen hill towns. So I kind of have a sensitivity to that, which I think helps in writing the guidebooks. So I started writing these books. Europe Through the Back Door is the How to Travel book. That was the most important of the 30 books that I've written.
Do we have one here? We've got that
Back door. There we go.
And Europe Through the Back Door is one of my favorite chores in my work. Every year after, 4 months of traveling, I come home and I go through this and I just splice in all the new stuff I've learned. For instance, I prided myself for years in not having to have air conditioning, sort of out of solidarity with people who have to sweat and can't afford air conditioning. And then I thought, this is ridiculous. I can't sleep. It's so hot in Italy in July. I remember, being defeated. I was with my family, and all of us were miserable, and I thought, we got to change hotels. It's too darn hot. You need air conditioning. So we moved the next day. It's just getting hot in the Mediterranean. And it's Americans fiddle with the remote on the air conditioning. We don't know. We like it to be 68 degrees or whatever. We don't know what that is in Celsius. And we don't know what all the icons mean to turn it on and off and make it whatever all the little things are. So there's a chart in here that just explains the icons on the air conditioning remote. Silly as that is, that's something that's going to frustrate you, and this book would have it. There's, for years I've said, if there's two thieves in town, you're going to meet them, right? That's the thieves in Europe target Americans. Not because they're mean, but because they're smart. We're the people with all the good stuff in our purses and wallets. So I say, take a purse or take a wallet, but expect to get it ripped off. In it, you've got just odds and ends, a day's spending money, and a funny little note to the thief. And then you go out there and have a good time. Well, I've been saying that little line for ages, and then I realized, well, let's make a funny little note to the thief. So the new edition has that funny little note to the thief. And a little, you cut it out and you put it in your wallet or your purse. And it says, in five languages, it says, "Dear thief, sorry there's not much money here. Why don't you get a real job?" All right? Wouldn't it be great to get ripped off and know they're going to read that? So so this is just my sort of my teaching, my joy is to get, here's a photograph of the 500 lira coin and the 2 euro coin. They're exactly the same. And tourists are always, or have been routinely given by bad people in Italy, the 500 euro lira coin instead of a 2 euro coin. 500 lira is worth nothing. Two euro coin is worth, nowadays is worth $3. So a little pitfall, just a little heads up. A lot of Americans insist on spending $2 a minute to call home. They insist on believing MCI or Sprint really care about you, actually. And the fact is, they don't. They just scare you into using their service. And I would say, if you want to call home, you can call home for a penny a minute, literally, by simply going to the kiosk where you get your Herald Tribune in the morning and you buy a little phone card with a PIN number that you scratch off and you reveal. And now you can go into your hotel room and literally call home. It's $5 for a card that gives you 500 minutes to call home. It's almost free. That's big news. And as a tour guide, I know routinely Americans are dialing direct from their hotel room. The next morning they're checking out and it's $40 for that 15-minute call. It's too expensive over there to make these kind of mistakes. So that's what Europe Through the Back Door is all about. That's the How to Travel book that I've enjoyed writing.
The new book that I'm very excited about is Europe 101, because I know from my tour guiding experience, boy, museums can ruin a good vacation, you know. And I'm good for a couple hours in the museums, and I know that, well, this book is designed for smart people, basically, who were sleeping in their history and art classes before they knew they were going to Europe. Now you got a trip coming up, and you wish you remembered who those Etruscans were, you know. And I know that if you just read 5 pages of information in here on Gothic architecture, you can step into a Gothic cathedral, excitedly nudge your partner and say, isn't this a marvelous improvement over Romanesque? You know, I mean, imagine getting excited about Gothic. Well, you're going to spend a lot of time in Gothic cathedrals, whether you like it or not. They're free. They're the biggest building in town. They're right at the main square. It's raining. Let's step in. And, you know, for years I stepped in and I looked in and I thought, this is big. And it's old. It's older than anything in my town. And that was the depth of my ability to appreciate Gothic, the triumph of the High Middle Ages. And just a little background really does make it fun. So this Europe 101 book is my effort after 25 years of tour guiding to make the sightseeing fun and meaningful. And the new edition is in full color. And the last third of it, or quarter of it, is, I think, a very important chapter called Europe Today. And there's so much going on in Europe today. That's what's exciting right now when you go to Europe. I really enjoy trying to keep on top of it, and it's always changing. Think about the European Union. A couple years ago, 10 nations joined, and overnight, the geographic center of Europe shifted from Belgium to the Czech Republic. And all of a sudden, you got all of the former Warsaw Pact as part of the European Union. Since 1947, Europhiles have been trying to talk European nations into trading away sovereignty for this ideal of a united Europe. United Europe is nothing if nations don't give away real sovereignty. And that's a tough sell, isn't it? It's a fitful thing, and they've been going 2 steps forward and 1 step back ever since. And a lot of people complain about the heavy bureaucracy and the ridiculous inefficiencies or whatever. But bottom line, it's a big free trade zone, 400 million people, with an economy of $13 trillion designed to compete with the United States. A big free trade zone of 300 million people with an economy the same size, $13 trillion. If anybody here who's a proponent of our system tries to put down Europe's system and say they don't make as much money as this, you should correct them a little bit, because they don't make as much money as us per person, but per hour they make at least as much as we do. They just choose to work less. It's their choice. Okay, statistically, I mean, you can just do the arithmetic. We have the shortest vacations in the rich world. And I don't know what it is about us, but we just want shorter vacations all the time. You know, we just want to buy more stuff. And Europe has not as much money per person, but I've got a friend who's running a very small movement here in the United States. It's called Take Back Your Time. And it's reminding Americans that we have this pathetic little vacation. We're sort of the laughingstock of the rest of the world. I wonder what's going on with you guys. You call yourself successful and free. And his national holiday is October 24th. Because by his estimate, if we were Europeans working as hard as we do here in the United States, on October 24th, you could stop going to work for the rest of the year and have longer vacations. So the point is, Europe has an effective economic system, but it's a whole different sort of outlook. In America, you got two options, big bad government or little good government. In Europe, there's a third option called big good government. It's interesting to me when I talk to my European friends, they pay high taxes, and their presidents and so on are very popular. And what's the deal? I asked my friend in Switzerland, Ollie, who's a school teacher there. He's my sounding board in Switzerland. I say, Ollie, how can you Swiss people so docilely pay such high taxes? And without missing a beat, he says, well, what's it worth to live in a country where there's no homelessness, no hunger, and where everybody's got access to quality education and healthcare? It's just the way they think, you know, and they expect good return for their high taxes. They don't want to throw their money away, but it's just a different kind of ethic over there. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I'm just saying it's very interesting as a traveler to grapple with that, because in the United States here, we're confronted with some pretty serious problems, and our European friends, they don't have all the answers, but they've done things a little differently than we have, and they seem to be succeeding. We lose 18,000 people a year on heroin overdose deaths. They lose 8,000 people a year. We don't even see our junkies because they're all dead or in jail, you know. In Europe, they're on the streets. It puts off a lot of Americans. What are all these junkies doing? Well, they're not dead and they're not in jail. They're going down to the clinic to get their fix. I was just in Switzerland filming. It's going to be on our new Switzerland show. They wanted me to shoot some new restaurant or something. I said, no, I want to go to the heroin maintenance clinic. And and I went. First of all, I went down into the bathroom at Starbucks in Zurich. Go down there, and blue light in the bathroom. What's going on? And I could not, for the life of me, find my veins.
frustrating, you know, when you really want to find those veins. And I realized, oh, they just don't, it's a public, essentially a public bathroom in a big city, and they got all these people looking for a place to shoot up. They don't want them in their bathrooms doing that. Blue light solves that problem, if you ever... All right. Now, you're not going to leave the junkie just frustrated. You go down the street and you find what used to be a cigarette dispenser that now dispenses syringes. I bought some. It was two Swiss francs for a little three-pack. And then you got down the street another block, you've got this heroin maintenance clinic with nurses and counselors and job counseling. You know, and you've got this situation where people are actually consuming less because they don't have the nervousness of where am I going to get my next fix. And they've got counselors to get themselves back on track and hold a job and not be such an expensive welfare problem. Why am I bringing that up? Because I'm really outspoken in American war on drugs and I'm trying to bring some common sense to this and just learn from Europe. And I think it's a good example of how we can learn that Europe has some different solutions. They think out of the box, and we should be challenged by that because clearly their situation is working better from a law enforcement point of view and from a health... Well, they measure their drug policy in terms of harm reduction to society. We measure it in terms of how many people do you lock up. Okay, so it's just a different sort of a thing. But there's time and time again, you go around Europe and you're challenged by this kind of stuff. In Chicago, I understand it's illegal for people to serve foie gras because they feel bad that the geese are force-fed. In southern France, they're inundated with English people who drive down there every year to pig out on the foie gras. When I'm in the Dordogne River Valley, it's foie gras heaven. I need foie gras detox when it's time to go. And, you know, we're so righteous about this, and if you knew where how our chickens grew up, pumped with hormones in little cages, never seeing the light of day, and then you go to a farm in the Dordogne, like I did with my film crew, and you show these, it looks like a muesli commercial. These geese out there just having the time of their life, four times a day go in for food, yeah, and then when it's time to get slaughtered, the people eat their big fat livers. It's a fascinating thing, you know. It's just, I just love it to be learning that. And for 25 years, I've been going over there, just stumbling into this kind of stuff. And it's just, I was just, forgive me for rambling here, but I didn't want to have a prepared talk for it. I just wanted to talk, and then I'll answer your questions. But for 20 years, I've called Tangier the armpit of Africa. I don't even know why. I just, if you've been, you know, if you go to southern Spain, you want to go down to Africa just to, you know, suck on a hookah and drink some mint tea. And you go down to Tangier, and it's a horrible place. Really disgusting. And then I learned on my last trip, just this summer, that's because Tangier, after World War II, was an international city. And it turned its back, basically, on Muslim traditional Morocco. And the king was upset about it. So the king never went there, and he never gave them a penny of federal money from the Moroccan capital. Consequently, Tangiers became a corrupt, horrible place and a scary place for tourists to go. Well, the new king, the first place he went after being crowned was Tangier. And he said, it's time to bring the fifth most important city of Morocco back into the fold and make it a great city once again. And I couldn't believe the change. And it was so cool for me in this environment that we live in today to go to a thriving Muslim town and find all these people succeeding in a thriving economy, and they didn't get out of the bed in the morning liking America or not liking America. We just weren't part of the equation. And I just thought, hallelujah, that is so beautiful. And to go there and to see that is a very important thing for us in our travels. And for me to be able to go down there and reassess Tangiers, it's a night and day difference, that town. And it's just a 90-minute hydrofoil ride away from Tarifa and Gibraltar. So these kind of things are my challenge in my work. And it's fun in my travels to check this out. A big issue for a lot of us is when you go to Dubrovnik, what's the best side trip? Everybody goes to Dubrovnik. It's the greatest town on the Adriatic coast there. But you want to go somewhere else. And all the time it's been Korčula. It's a little mini Venice there, a couple hours north of Dubrovnik. Cute town, very touristy, and I think I wanted to find something better. So on this last trip, I went to Montenegro, and I went to Bosnia. I went to a little island in the Bay of Kotor. There's these guys that just motor you out there in their little dinghies from the little town, and there is a vision of Mary. So for centuries, the fishermen, when they went out to sea, they would drop a rock on the place where the vision of Mary was until they built an island, and then they built a church on that island. And then one lady, humble, poor lady, who was very devout, spent 20 years of her life embroidering this beautiful religious piece of art that was going to hang on the wall of her church. And It was a crucifix or something like that. And then all around the thing, you had little angels, little tiny baby angels or cupids. And it took her 20 years, and you could see, and she wove it with the finest material she could get. She wove it with silk and with her own hair. And you could see over 20 years, when you look at the little angels, her hair getting gray, from brown to gray, as the project went on. And I just thought, what a touching, beautiful thing that almost nobody sees, you know. And had I not gotten onto that little dinghy and gone out into that bay and checked it out, would have never known it. In the other direction, you can go up to Bosnia, and the thriving city there is Mostar. And when you go to Mostar, remember, 15 years ago, they were killing each other. It's a divided community, and you've got religious people on different sides of this ethnic divide or cultural divide sniping each other. There's bomb marks in the street. You know, when a bomb hits it, it's like a... And they pave it with red asphalt so that it's called a Sarajevo rose as a reminder that there was a bomb there. It's still smooth now, but they got that red filling. The buildings are still bombed out because the Bank of Yugoslavia owns them, and the Bank of Yugoslavia is gone with Yugoslavia, and nobody can figure out who owns it, so they're not going to renovate it. The parents who were raping and killing each other, their children are now dancing together in the crazy discos, and the parks are now filled with tombstones all with the same year, 1993. They had to bury their loved ones in parks because the cemetery was in view of the snipers, so they couldn't go over to the cemetery. And they would bury their loved ones after dark in the park. Poignant stuff. And to walk through there today and feel all the hope and the desire for peace really was a beautiful experience. So for me, clearly now, the side trip from Dubrovnik that's most exciting is Mostar. I just absolutely love Mostar. And consequently, we would research that and put it into our book. But that's the kind of work we have to do in our books. Our books are... I don't believe there's any book in the United States that everything in it is updated every year in person, except these books. I have an unusual little business equation where I can put more research, invest more time and money in the research of these books than most people could, because of my tour program, and the TV show helps the books sell better and all this kind of thing. So it all works together, and consequently the books are able to get more care than they really deserve by the royalties you get. And what I'm able to do with, I like to do it personally, but with my staff and me, is just visit every place every year and update the book every year. And we're very proud of that, and I'm surprised nobody else is doing it, frankly. But other publishers just, for instance, I think I'm about the only travel writer these days getting straight royalties. They've done away with that now because they don't want to deal with a guy with his name on the cover. I mean, he's a real person that you're going to have to keep happy over the years. And now they just farm the work out to the guy who will do the work for a set fee. And next year they'll have somebody else do it who doesn't care about the book. He's just laboring over there. So it's a tough situation for travel writers, and it's a tough situation for consumers to get guidebooks that have a little personality in them and a little passion and a real care for the quality. That's why I think it's just kind of good old-fashioned quality that these things are selling very well. I was just in Rome for a week, and I'll tell you, it's a great place to research. I went to all the sites and ate in all the restaurants and learned a lot of new stuff. In fact, let me just... Oops, I don't want to talk too long, but I just have a few notes from my trip. In Italy, they're very curious about this charismatic politician in the United States named Alabama or something like that. Alabama. Alabama, does he have enough experience? And they're bringing back Berlusconi. You know, this, I don't really follow the politics, but he apparently is the most, he owns all the media, and he's just you know, he thumbs his nose at anything to do with integrity in government, but people are voting for him because for the same reason they voted for Mussolini. You know, to forget democracy, I want action. I want something done. And I met a lot of people that are all for Berlusconi. So just in the last 4 days, signs all over town are going up with Berlusconi. I thought it was a huge triumph of democracy to get rid of the guy a year or two ago when they did that, and now he comes back. And my friends tell me they're very inspired by how we can have these big rallies for Obama and so on, and families getting together and going and waiting in line to see him. They don't have any of that charisma and energy and rebirth or whatever you call it, in Italy. It's just the same old guys, and people are pretty much disillusioned with their political process.
My son's over there, and he wants to write a book called Italy After Dark, or Italy in the Wee Hours, I think. And all these students over there, their day just starts when they're students at midnight, and they go to all the clubs. And I learned that the clubs in Italy, they'll play hip-hop as long as they want the American students there. But when they think it's time for the American students to take off, they'll play techno, because that's what the kids in Italy would rather have, is the techno. I met a lot of American students over there that like it so much they stay. And for their summer break, or for their spring break, they go not to Fort Lauderdale, but to Sharm el-Sheikh on the Black Sea, or in the Red Sea in Egypt. And I just thought it's interesting. I don't think of like frat parties in Egypt, but there are resorts on the Red Sea that are just as crazy as the MTV specials you might have seen in Fort Lauderdale. In Rome, a lot of people nicknamed the Pope Nazi Inger. They just don't like him. It's very Germanic. And the common comment I always heard was, it's too bad he's so young. In other words, the new Pope's going to be around for a while. I've learned this a few years ago, but I've enjoyed doing this research in my book. If you know your Jewish history and so on, during the diaspora, when the Romans destroyed the temple and all the Jews had to scatter, one branch went to Eastern Europe and one branch went to Spain, right? Sephardic and what's the other word? Thank you. And there was about 3% of Europe's Jewish community that is in Rome. And they predate the diaspora, because they were a delegation that went from Israel right to Rome to establish trade relations. And that community has been there for 2,000 years, over 2,000 years. And there's families that now are still carrying on in their traditional way. They have different cuisine, different dialect, different style of worship and everything. And it's a beautiful little community, and you can get a local guide and learn about that right there in Rome. I've got a friend who's a local guide there, and her family's been there for more than 2,000 years. There's all these little options that you have when you travel, and I just think it's so important to equip yourself with good information and then expect it to work for you. And that's why I'm a big fan of the value of guidebooks. I mean, I really see guidebooks as $20 tools for $3,000 experiences. So many people are penny wise and pound foolish when it comes to information. You see them, you know, basing their trip on a borrowed copy of some guidebook in order to save $20. Well, you saved $20, but I think you lost that savings on the shuttle in from the airport. Frankly, I mean, the stakes are huge over there. They're huge. And one guidebook pays for itself. Even a guidebook I didn't write pays for itself in one day. I mean, when I go to a place I don't write about, I equip myself with a good guidebook. I expect myself to travel like an old pro, and I do. There's two kinds of, that's a mark of, I think, a smart traveler. You know, it's always occurred to me that if people just took their trip as thoughtfully as I would take it if you hired me to show you around, you could travel very smartly. One thing in Europe is a big deal these days is lines, crowds. There's two, as far as I can tell, there's two IQs of European travelers, those who wait in lines and those who do not wait in lines. If you're waiting in a line, you're messing up. There's lots of ways to get around it if you want to. I was just over there just using the guidebook, and you can do that, and that's good news. You may think not many people may be traveling because of our financial situation or because of our nervousness about terrorism or whatever, but more people are traveling than ever. Europe is crowded. One thing I want to remind you, the most grueling thing physically about European travel is the heat and the crowds of summer. If you're concerned about your ability to do it and enjoy it, scoot yourself into shoulder season, April, October, beautiful time to go. I was just in Rome for a week in February, and it was just gorgeous. It was really a nice time to be there. I think I need to wrap it up, and I just really have enjoyed meeting with you all. Happy travels. All right.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on February 28th, 2008.